Hey, everybody. Welcome to Talking Serverless. This is the podcast where we talk about serverless. My name is Paul Chin Jr. I'm a senior serverless developer at Serverless Guru, the wonderful producers of this show. And today I have a really exciting guest, Simon McDonald from Begin. Begin is one of those companies that is doing so much pioneering work in serverless. They've got all kinds of tools and workflows and just new ideas, I think, that the rest of the community should totally hear about. And so thanks so much today for joining us. And Simon, thanks so much for being here. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and begin to our guests.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on, Paul. And my name is Simon McDonald. I'm the head of developer experience at Begin. I'm also a Canadian. I should probably get that out of the way immediately because I will sound funny to some of your American listeners, and I will prove it by saying about. I don't hear it, but lots of other people do. I've been working at Begin for just over 2 years now, and Begin is a company where we build everything with a serverless mindset. The elevator pitch for Begin is basically you open up the AWS console, you see 200 different services that you can choose from, you are overwhelmed by the paradox of choice, you close your laptop, you walk into the woods, you think about what you've done wrong in your life to get you to this point. So basically what we do at Begin is we set you up with a bunch of reasonable defaults that you can start building applications right away, because we also think of the beginner mindset. We were all beginners at one point in time, and we don't want people to have to make a million decisions just to start building websites. We want them to just focus on the business logic and start coding right away.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, that is the promised land of serverless, right? Not worrying about a lot of things and only being able to put your effort into the business logic and the code and just shipping code, right? Just get it shipped and get it working. When I was taking a look at around all of the things that Begin does, I noticed that y'all had this concept of a functional web app, an FWA, and it has been kind of growing over the last maybe two or three years since you came up with the idea. And it's like it's a different way to package and approach the idea of just web apps. So for those that haven't heard of this term before, can you kind of give us an explanation of what a functional web app is?
Sure, no problem. And I think I should probably start with anybody who wants to read more about functional web apps, if they go to fwa.dev. I just wanted to get that URL out there because like we're really good at technology, but we're really bad at naming things. Because if you try to Google functional web app, you may not find it, but you'll see that same thing as we talk about more of the open source projects that we work at Begin. Functional web apps are more than just applications that just work. You know, mind you, it'd be super nice if we could just wave a magic wand and have all of our web apps work reliably. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I go to a lot of websites these days, and it's like it should not be this hard to buy a pair of pants, and yet it is because there's, you know, issues with the web applications. But basically, functional web apps is an architectural pattern that we've discovered at Begin after building web applications for many, many years. A few ways that developers can think of functional web apps that, you know, could, you know, basically help them out is that, you know, first and foremost, anybody can build a functional web app. You don't need to learn a new framework. I mean, you don't need to worry about learning Angular, React, Vue, or whatever the framework du jour is. You can, as long as you know HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, then you can write a functional web app. And as we alluded to earlier, the overall focus on things is just writing business logic. You can skip, you know, figuring out how to deploy your Kubernetes cluster. You don't have to worry about standing up a database. You just start building your application. So you're writing code. It really helps you like prototype things, get your ideas out there, see if you actually have something instead of, you know, spending, you know, $2.4 billion on NVIDIA graphic chips. You know, I mean, it's a crazy thing. Anyway, and as well, it really helps you significantly lower your total cost of ownership because as you're getting started, you don't immediately need to hire an SRE. You don't need to hire a DBA. You know, those are expensive roles. So you can take advantage of serverless in order to be able to provide that to you. FWA is also, you know, we want you to have a local development environment that mirrors what you have in the cloud. So that enables you to do like very rapid local development. And then the other pillar of FWAs is infrastructure as code. Your testing environment, your local environment, your staging, your production, all of these environments should be as close to identical as possible, because you don't want to be trying to debug a bug that only shows up in production, but you can't reproduce it in staging because those environments are totally different. Maybe it's the memory, maybe it's the database. So if those all match, you're going to be able to debug those things a lot easier. And by using infrastructure as code, you can quickly reproduce those environments all across the board.
Cool. Cool. So a functional web app or an FWA is more like a manifesto, sort of like the 12 factor methodology. It's sort of all of its different components of architectures and decisions that come together to make a resilient application.
Yeah, and it borrows a lot from functional programming as well, because all of the things are built using cloud functions. So you have single purposes, you just write the business logic for that, you can chain them together, you can build applications out of multiple functions, much in the way that you do functional program, but we're just like taking it to a serverless cloud application way of building things.
Gotcha, cool. So would you say that, you know, to build these functional web apps, a developer can really, like, there are already existing tools that a developer can just jump in and start using in order to get these kind of benefits?
Yeah, I mean, you can build a functional web app on kind of any platform. Over at Begin, we've kind of decided to standardize on AWS. So we've just gone all in on our particular cloud provider so we get the most benefit from it. But you can build the same thing on Microsoft, or you could use GCP, or, you know, any kind of other cloud provider. But for us personally, since we spent so much time doing things with AWS, we built another open source project called Architect, which enables the deployment and the infrastructure as code portions of functional web apps. We make that a lot easier. So we don't hand maintain CloudFormation, because that way leads to madness.
It does. True madness does follow CloudFormation.
Yes.
You know, recently I started doing a series of blog posts where I'm rebuilding the same service, but with like all the different IAC tools out there. I started with SAM, and then I just built with CDK. And it's a pretty, you know, basic service. There's an upload function that'll put an item onto S3, and then the S3 triggers another Lambda to write the metadata to a Dynamo table. And like, that's it. That's all I wanted to do. And, you know, it has been interesting to see the different paradigm, just especially just between just SAM and CDK, how completely different the mindset is of the developer who's declaring these resources. You know, you had mentioned Architect. I love Architect. It's such a neat, like, all-in-one deployment solution for AWS. And at Serverless Guru, you know, we also only focus on AWS because it's easier and it's probably better, you know, for you to have a single focus and to really know one provider and know all the ins and outs and all the gotchas and everything, so that when we go to ultimately deliver these solutions, we're very confident in how well they'll perform. For our listeners who haven't played around with Architect yet, could you give us a kind of like a basic introduction to it and where they could find it?
Yeah. So again, to find it, if you go to arc.codes, you will find all the documentation and how to get started with Architect. But basically, Architect is an open source project, and the code is donated to the OpenJS Foundation. So this project's never going to go away. You can be quite sure that it'll be supported for quite some time. The nice thing about Architect is that we provide you a way of defining your resources in your serverless application, whether they be your Lambdas, your S3 buckets, your DynamoDB tables, events, queues, et cetera, et cetera. So all that is defined into a very terse format, which we call ARC or Architect. And then we generate that CloudFormation for you. So you can imagine like just setting up a Lambda, DynamoDB, and an S3 bucket. And it's like, that's maybe six lines in an Architect file. And then when you generate the CloudFormation, it's 1200 lines. So I got to tell you, I would much rather maintain a six line file than a 1200 line file. So we make kind of that deploying to AWS a lot easier. And what I referred to earlier is like the Architect project, it's always going to be there. But if you decide that you want to eject from Architect, you no longer want to use the ARC format, that's okay. You can do that because you have the CloudFormation. You can take that and deploy directly to AWS using one of their tools. The other nice thing is that Architect will allow you to test locally. We have the ARC sandbox, which will emulate the Lambda environment, the S3 and DynamoDBs, as well as give you tools to be able to call your events and queues. So that just enables you to do a lot of rapid development locally. I as a developer experience person, I seem to spend a lot of time on planes with bad Wi-Fi. So it's absolutely great for me because I can like sit there on the plane and actually come up with like a sample application, without having to like deploy to the cloud. And a lot of other, providers are trying to do this thing where they, always deploy to the cloud so that you can, test in the cloud all the time. But I don't know about you, the internet's not always that reliable. Sometimes you're on planes or trains or automobiles, or unfortunately there was a winter storm in the East Coast, which for one of our coworkers knocked out his power for 4 days. But he was still able to get some work done, which is pretty wild. I don't know about you. I'm pretty lazy. If I had my power knocked out, I'd probably just call it a day and not work on stuff. But that's why we like them.
Yeah. Ironically, when you have a client that's using like Bitbucket, and then GitHub goes down,
yeah,
and but you're on Bitbucket, so you can keep working. You're like, darn it, I'm on this like secondary tier that's always gonna be up because no one's attacking it all the time.
Yeah, sometimes it's great to be like a smaller provider on things, but then on other times, where part of Amazon or part of Azure goes down, and 30% of the internet is just down. It's like, yeah, that's definitely a day to go for a walk in the woods.
Yeah, totally. Totally. For what I love about Architect is that it does have that ARC file, right? For our listeners, it's hard to imagine on a podcast, but instead of writing long CloudFormation or writing YAML, you declare on a single line kind of like the heading of the thing that you want, like a database, and then all like just the bare information that's needed to stand it up, and then the Architect process will turn it into, it will expand that into all the CloudFormation that you'll need, which is really amazing. And then in addition to the local developer experience, can you tell us about how local dev actually works? Because for folks that are working in the cloud all the time, I think it is almost by default where logging into the AWS CLI, uploading code changes incrementally and like hitting the actual cloud. But with Architect, you do have that local sandbox thing. So like, how does that work? Is there like a container? Like, do I have to set up a whole bunch of containers on my machine or what?
Whenever possible, we avoid Kubernetes containers or Docker containers. Basically, the ARC sandbox process itself, you run it inside of your Architect application, and it's just going to watch for any changes to the files. If there are changes to the files, it'll do any of the necessary steps in order to make them available, to be run. But when you hit, one of the Lambda routes, what it does is takes that URL and then calls the code that would be executed that URL as a separate node process. So it's kind of just like running like node to the actual file name, but it's going to have the kind of an API gateway in front of things so that it can route those requests properly. On the database side of things, we're using a project called Dynalite. The maintainer of Dynalite actually donated the source code to the Architect project as well. So we're now the maintainers of Dynalite, which is a way of emulating DynamoDB locally. Of course, every run of the application on local sandbox is completely clean, much in the same way that it would be if you're deploying a cloud function as well, because you're starting up that container again. But with Dynalite, you're able to provide some seed data in a file, whether it be JSON or by calling some API calls, so that you can emulate the database locally as well.
Wow. Okay. That's really cool. I think is Dynalite the only real project that's emulating Dynamo locally?
It's definitely the most mature one. There's probably other ones out there, but you might go to the repo and see last updated 6 years ago. But at least Dynalite is relatively complete and under active maintenance right now.
Perfect. That's so cool. Yeah, I don't think I've come across another solution like a serverless stack that includes local development in the same way that Arc does.
Yeah, we really love it's extremely close to what it's like deploying to the cloud. Obviously, you still need to deploy to your staging environment before you just huck things directly into production. And that is one of the nice things about the Arc deploy function, is that we by default set up two different environments for you, the staging environment and your production environment. So what we generally recommend to people is use tag-based deployment. So any kind of git commit will get deployed to staging, and then once you tested things on staging and you're happy with them, then tag it, and then that deploy will end up in production. And so you've kind of have your rapid local development, you've got your testing on staging, and then you finally got your production app, because you never want your production app to go down,
right? Yeah, that again, solar flares we were talking about earlier, all kinds of wild natural phenomenon can take you out. But if you're using solid fundamentals with good battle tested tools, you can minimize a lot of the nonsense out there.
Yeah, I think there was a really good blog post years ago about boring technology, and I've just recently seen it making the rounds again. And boring technology is rock solid. It's not always great to be chasing the latest fad or fashion, especially when it comes to JavaScript. And believe me, I've been a JavaScript programmer for a long time, and I've seen this. But yeah, there's things that was good enough, and I wrote that code 8 years ago, and I've never had to change it, and I've never had to really maintain it, as opposed to picking this new tool that they change the API every 2 weeks on. And that's just signing up for a whole bunch of work that you don't need.
Right. Yeah. I've now been doing this long enough to where I've actually seen cycles come through of hype cycles of JavaScript frameworks and sort of the way things are done. And it always what I do is I come back to the basics, right? Where's the GET request? Where's the POST request? Those are the two things I know I can always count on in a web application.
Well, I am significantly older than you, so I have seen so many things. I started building web applications back when they were CGI bin scripts. So I am that level of old. So we were happy when Perl came along, because before that we were writing CGI bin in C. Which amazing to think that we used to write scripts in C and have them executed on our university's server. And for some reason, they trusted us to do that. So obviously, there's the Unix permissions that kept us from doing too much damage. But a really improperly coded for loop could put the server into a denial of service attack from itself, which was hilarious, which is actually something that happened in university for me. There's a lot of fashion and things, but yeah, going back to what you said about there's always the API calls. They always have to hit that RESTful API. And it's I forget about all this syntactical sugar on top of things. And we focus on those API calls, and you can get a lot done with that instead.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the value of digging into a single vendor like AWS with a good programming model like serverless can really go a long way. And y'all at Begin keep building the most insane stuff. For instance, I saw where y'all have redone the AWS SDK into like a newer, more compact, concise tool. And it's called AWS Lite. And I first heard about it at reInvent when it was announced. And I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. Because I had been wrestling with, you know, the transition from SDK v2 to v3. And then y'all came out with AWS Lite. So could you tell me about it and kind of how it came about and why people should take a look at it?
Yeah, sure. And yeah, we are insane. We fully cop to that. Sometimes we do things that people think are crazy, but for a good reason. First and foremost, let me just say that the folks at AWS have done an excellent job of supporting developers for many years. Unfortunately, AWS is a little bit hamstrung by their own success. So you have these teams that are building SDKs in order to, you know, get access to all the AWS services. And since AWS is so successful and they have so many languages that they have to support, AWS SDK v3 is basically done by code generation. So they run like code generation tools in order to spit out the JavaScript, the TypeScript, the, you know, the Rust, the Go, the Python, the Ruby, all of those different SDKs. And as a result, anytime that you run code generation tools, you kind of get larger dependencies, some poor performance, some really weird semantics because, yeah, it's a code generation tool. And then, you know, the documentation is a bit off and don't even get me started on the stack traces. Have you ever, you ever tried to read? Yeah, obviously you've tried to read a V3 stack trace and you're like, nope, I just don't know what that is. And then because the SDK V2 is deprecated, it's going away, SDK V3 was left as really the only game in town. And what we really noticed is that the step from V2 to V3 was a real downgrade in performance for us, particularly because we're running all of our business on top of AWS, mostly through Lambdas and other serverless technologies, so that we could see that the SDK V3 was bigger, cold starts were worse, interactivity time took longer to get there. And we decided that, you know, we don't want to do it, but we're going to have to do it. And we wrote our own SDK in order to interact with AWS. And the way in that we did that is kind of something that we talked about earlier, was just going right back to the original REST API calls. So instead of, you know, having these things, you know, generated by a computer, we had, you know, developers, you know, I don't want to say artisanally create the interface for you, but they actually thought meaningful about the interface and how they would do this. And so we're calling the AWS SDKs directly instead of under layers and layers and layers of code. And what we found is that AWS Lite is anywhere between 2 to 5 times faster than the AWS SDK v3. And then, of course, from a developer ergonomics perspective, you know, we handcrafted the documentation. When it came to doing stack traces, you know, there's not, you know, a million levels of dependencies that you have to sift through. So stack traces are a lot easier to understand. And one of the biggest things is that anytime you've dealt with AWS, it's like, hey, sometimes the service returns JSON and the service returns XML. And this one returns a specially formatted version of JSON that only Amazon uses. So we just kind of like smoothed over those differences, and that any of the responses that come back, we'll just provide them to you in JSON. And that way you can, you know, rapidly build your applications.
Nice. Nice. So is this something that developers can just drop in and kind of switch out for the SDK, for like V3 SDK?
As like a, just drop in the code as a replacement and not have to change their business logic?
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no. There's no way that we could exactly map the APIs the same. You know, honestly, though, if somebody really wanted to, they could probably write an adapter or a plugin on top of things. But AWS SDK, the AWS Lite SDK at its core, it provides a client interface, and that allows you to call those REST APIs that AWS provides But we also have a plugin interface, which allows you to build kind of a saner version of all of the different services. So we've written plugins for many of the services, especially the ones that we use, like S3 and Lambda, DynamoDB, and you know, we will take contributions from anybody. So unfortunately, it's not a drop-in replacement, but we had migrated all of our code from using the AWS SDK to AWS Lite, and it was not like 2 months of work. It was more like 2 weeks of work. So,
all right, cool. Yeah. I haven't had a chance to check it out yet, and I was waiting for you to come on the show so I could poke questions about it, but definitely, I really do want to check it out. And I think it's something pretty cool, because in the JavaScript world right now, you know, it's all about the optimization of performance of like runtime and every library. You know, people are taking a very deep and considered look at how the code is running, because it was way too simple to just bloat out all your projects, npm installing everything, and it makes the lambdas perform worse, right? And so now we have to be a little bit more considerate about what we include in the zip packages that we're uploading, right?
Yeah, we have a saying for that at work. It's called npm installing your way to success. And it's like, oh, I need this. And then people immediately reach to NPM. They search it. They find a package that kind of does what they think it should do. They add it to the project. And then they're surprised when it runs slow. And it's like, yeah, the more code that you add, you know, the slower your cold starts are going to be, because that code has to be downloaded and installed in the Lambda. And then what I've really noticed is that the thing that takes the most amount of time is the initialization. So if your code has a bunch of dependencies and it has to import those dependencies, you know, parse them and compile them, that can take a crap ton of time. And so one of the things we did when building AWS Lite was just agonize over absolutely every dependency that got in there, because we knew that every dependency that was out of our control could potentially hurt us with cold start or initialization time. And so we got it down to just two dependencies. There's two external dependencies on AWS Lite. And one of them is the AWS for library for signing things. And it's like, yeah, we didn't want to write that. We're insane, but we're not that insane. So we're going to install that one. So,
I mean, how often do you need to rebuild cryptography libraries, really? I mean,
I think everybody should try it once. Once.
Yes. So we've talked about sort of Architect, which is the framework, right? And deployment tool. And then AWS Lite, which is the client SDK optimization. So, you know, you all at Begin don't stop at just the back end. You also have a front end solution that is different than any other front end solution. It's called Enhance. And I love that it's HTML first and, you know, has all the nice things about progressively enhanced, like built into the name of the framework.
Yeah.
But again, it is a little weird to Google, and I wanted to ask you about it on the show. Could you tell us what is Enhance? How do we get to it? And like, where does it fit in with all the other tools we've talked about?
Yeah, sure thing. And like I mentioned earlier, yeah, we're great at building stuff. We're bad at marketing stuff. I mean, you can see like, oh, our company is called Begin. We have functional web apps. We have Architect. We have Enhance. These are all nouns that are used all over the place. So they may not have the Google juice that you initially would be hoping for, but you know, we like them anyway.
Hopefully after this podcast goes out and our viewers get all over it, you'll get a little bump in traffic.
Well, I hope so. And I'm sure it will help. But again, if you want to learn more about Enhance, the best place to go is the website enhance.dev. So it'll give you all the documentation and information there. So once again, the Enhance framework, it came out of just the way that we were building applications at Begin. So in programming, you've heard of the rule of least power, where it's a design principle where you should always choose the least powerful language suitable for the given purpose. So if you're building web applications, what that means is pick HTML when HTML can do the job. Then if it can't, then you use CSS. And then if that doesn't fit, then you sprinkle on some JavaScript. You know, this is kind of the way that we talk about progressive enhancement. And, you know, I grew up like, you know, this is the way we approach things. And for some reason, progressive enhancement got to be somewhat of a dirty word at some point in time. I don't know why people got away from it. But if you approach things that way, you'll find that your applications are way more performant because you're not bloating your client with a bunch of JavaScript. But by kind of using that rule of least power and we're approaching building applications, you know, we found that we were building lots of server-side templates in order to make composing our HTML a lot easier. But, you know, we kind of coveted writing components because components are cool, and it's really great to, you know, co-locate your UI, your business logic together, and, you know, into a reusable component that you could use in multiple projects. But kind of our forays into heavyweight JavaScript frameworks like Angular or React or Vue left us feeling a bit wanting. We'd written a lot of things in these frameworks. I was a React developer for 7 years. It's, you know, it's kind of one of these things where, and we might talk about it later, but we always did things server-side rendered. That's the way the web started. And then things switched to client-side rendered. And, you know, they went back to server-side rendered. And then they went back to client. And it's this kind of pendulum that swings back and forth. And we tend to learn things from going to either extreme. And what we're really trying to do with Enhance is kind of get into that happy middle where you have just basically something that works from the server-side on down, but you can still progressively enhance it with some client-side JavaScript. But what we really notice with a lot of the heavyweight frameworks is that they would break us all the time. We would just, you know, we'd be building an application and especially with Lambdas, you would be like, oh, you know, execute this for me. And it's like, well, what happened here? Why did it break? And it's like, because some dependency in React land changed and they broke everything. And it's like, well, great. So we decided that there must be some kind of better way to do things. And we really wanted to use web standards in order to build our applications. And that's really where web components come in. Web components are now available on like all evergreen browsers. So your Chromes, your Firefoxes, your Safaris, your Edges. But web components aren't really just like one thing. They're a suite of different specifications. And primarily the ones that are most available right now is custom elements, shadow DOM, and then your slots and templates. But they come with an Achilles heel, and that is you need client-side JavaScript in order to work with web components. Because in order to register your custom element with the browser, you need to call custom elements define with your tag name and your implementation. And that doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but there's lots of situations where, you know, JavaScript might not work. Solar flares, for instance. I know we've talked. But I mean, you could be on a train with bad Wi-Fi. You could be on a plane trying to build things. You could be on a captive portal. There's all sorts of reasons why JavaScript might fail, and we really wanted things to work right from the initial page load. So, you know, what we found is that we were able to write our web components and then expand them on the server side. So we take that template, we expand it, we send it down the wire as light DOM HTML to the client. So the initial page render, you already have HTML that's working. You can do things with forms. You can do a lot of the presentation stuff. People aren't waiting for the JavaScript to show up. But then when the JavaScript does show up, that's where, you know, you sprinkle that extra bit of interactivity in there. You know, you add some of the sizzle or the things that really delight your customers. So you're enhancing that custom element into a fully fledged web component. So that works like really quite well. And I guess really like another one of the key points of Enhance is that as we were doing this, we were finding that close to like 80% of the components that we were writing were presentational only and didn't need any JavaScript. So we can avoid needing client-side JavaScript in order to, like, you know, build our headers and our footers and our table of contents. Like, there's no reason you would need client-side JavaScript for that. And you just really focus in on the interactivity piece. And then when you have less JavaScript coming down the wire, your pages load faster, and then, you know, your load times are better, and your interaction to next paint scores are so much better because, you know, you're not reliant upon JavaScript for every last thing on the page. Anyway, that was a lot of talking about enhance. I'm sure you may have some questions.
Well, I think that that illustrates, you know, kind of what enhance does very well. You use the power of server-side processing to make these sort of optimistic calls for the client. You know, you're pre-compiling all of these custom elements. And the one pattern that I really loved from working with Begin in Architect is using the Lambda function to return that HTML string, right? Like, you're using the Lambda to do all of the logic so that, like, you grab your template, you grab your data, and you know where you're sending it to the client and what the client's going to be expecting. So the Lambda function is just going to return a string of HTML that the browser is just going to happily take in and display, you know, without having to bootstrap a bunch of scripts on the client side. And that's a really wonderful pattern. And I think more serverless developers should try it out because it is so streamlined.
Yeah, it's often people would often go to us like, oh, you're doing this wrong by sending HTML down to the client. It's like, that's the way browsers were written.
Like, yeah.
Browsers were written to take HTML first and then CSS and then JavaScript. They weren't taken to take JavaScript and then more JavaScript and even more JavaScript. And it always would drive me nuts when you would see like a modern web framework where it's like, you know, you have your HTML tag, your head, your body, and there was a div, and it's like, put stuff in here. And it was just like, that's where the script tag dumps everything. So what ends up at your client is just like a white page with a div that the browser would have to figure out what to paint in there.
Right.
That's no way to do it. Like, you have these incredibly powerful servers that you already have all the data. You know what things should look like. You should send something working down to the client because, you know, we are incredibly blessed, you know, here in Canada and the United States. We have really great internet, you know, and knock on wood for the most part. We have incredibly fast computers and phones, but that's not true of all of our users. And I think like the most popular phone in the world is an Android phone, which is equivalent to an iPhone that came out 6 years ago. So, you know, I got an iPhone 14 over there. I love it. It's great, but it's not representative of a lot of what my users are actually, you know, having on a day-to-day basis. So anything we can do to make their life easier is going to make them happier. It's going to lead to better outcomes, whether it's, you know, from sales or just, you know, anything to do with your web application. Studies have shown that the better that it performs, the faster it loads, the more successful it ends up being.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that with front-end technologies, it's easy to get completely overblown, like with all of the technical minutiae. Like, whenever I see new announcements from a framework that says, oh, we're now more isometric, you run the same code on the front end and the back end, and you just sort of say, like, use client or use server. And then when you actually start to write applications that way and start to debug them, you find out that, like, oh, this extra layer of abstraction is really kind of annoying when you're trying to figure out what went wrong. And it's almost like too optimistic to say, like, oh yeah, I'm going to have the same code on the front end and the back end, when the architecture you've been doing this longer than I have, but I would imagine that the architecture assumes two different use cases because they are two different environments. So why would the programming model try to unify them now with the server client relationship, right? It's not like you're building a video game that has, you know, everything self-contained on your desktop. And all of the, like, a lot of the magic functions and the magic, like, tie-ins throughout the frameworks make the error and stack traces, like, completely, like, unreadable.
Yeah, it's just it comes to, like, unusable, unmaintainable code. And, I was in the presentation last year where they were talking about, the new React server components. And it was like, this is so great. We've invented server-side rendering. And I was just sitting there with a friend who is also a graybeard. And we're like, this is how things started. It's like, you didn't invent this. And just seeing that, you know, the use client, use server tag, and seeing how easy it would be to infect the application with, like, one use client call, like, very low, and that it would bubble all the way up in your system, and you would lose all the server-side rendering capabilities of it. So in one case, isomorphic JavaScript kind of seems like it's a lofty goal, but it hasn't proven out to be a worthwhile one. Like you said, the programming models are completely different between the client and the server, and they probably should be like that. The other thing is, in that same presentation, one of the other folks, I did not know them, they were asking, like, well, I was on this version of your framework and now I'm struggling upgrading to the next version and everything's breaking and we can't figure it out and our company is failing. And, you know, they're saying, like, oh yeah, you just need to do this. And he's like, okay. And I had to tell the poor guy on the way out, he's like, they're releasing the next version tomorrow. So you're going to be two versions behind. So everything they told you about upgrading to the, you know, N-1, well, it's going to be out of date in 24 hours. And the look of absolute fear on his face, I felt so bad for this gentleman. So,
yeah, there's a couple of hooks. I mean, even going from, I guess this is not a rant against React show, but
it could be. It could be.
The way that it has evolved over time to, I feel like they've added things just to keep the code base flowing, right? It's almost like a shark's got to keep swimming in the water.
I make the argument that it's the shiny new toy syndrome. And it's like I developed in React for 7 years. And it seemed every 12 to 18 months, they would completely reinvent the API. So you would go to a new version of React, you would get a new API, you'd learn all about it, you'd update your application to use the new API, you would feel like you accomplished something, you got something done. It was a good feeling. But then you realize that I just spent X number of sprints or however many weeks running in place. That's all I did, is I just ran in place. My application doesn't provide any more benefits to the users. I've just updated the APIs that it was calling. And that is kind of what we say, like, do not sign up for other people's unplanned work. It's like, you know, you need to be focusing on the business logic, what brings value to your customers, and not what some other corporation thinks is the best way to develop things. And again, not to become the React bashing show, but React is because Facebook, now Meta, had a certain set of issues and they created a framework in order to make dealing with those issues a lot better. And that's great. It solves their problem, but it doesn't make it a general purpose solution for every web application that's ever been made. You don't need React in order to build web apps if you don't want to.
Right. Exactly. It, I guess we technologists are easily swayed when you have big fancy presentations on a stage and you announce SDKs and toolkits like an Apple product. But I guess let's bring it back to Begin a little bit. I guess the final thing I wanted to ask about Begin is, like, the Begin deploy service. So, like, we've got Architect where, like, I can use my AWS account and set up my own CI, but then there's also this, like, Begin deploy service. So could you kind of introduce that and tell us about it?
Yeah, sure. Although I am remiss because I there's something that I meant to mention about Enhance, and it's still super new because we only announced it yesterday.
Oh,
yeah. So this is we were like guys, we got to get this out so I can talk about it on Paul's podcast. So basically, Enhance SSR, which is a node process. So, you know, we do a lot of things with JavaScript. That is our language of choice, but we understand that it's not everybody's language of choice. And especially when you're in a serverless environment, you can pick pretty much any language you want to run in a Lambda. So what we've actually done is taken the Enhance server-side rendering package. We've compiled it into WASM, and now you can call it from any language. So if you're a Ruby developer or a Python developer or a Go developer, like, we have support for you now. So we're still going to continue to build things with JavaScript because that's the language that we're used to. But if your shop is based off of Ruby and you want to try it Enhance, you can do that now. So if your server is written in PHP, you can use this stuff now. And we're actually, you know, seeing a lot of excitement from the WordPress community because it's a huge community that's really been underserved. And so, you know, we're going around, we're starting to make some noise about Enhance WASM now. And, you know, hopefully people will get a chance to take a look at it.
Oh, wow. Committing to the WASM translation layer. That's awesome.
Yeah. And another thing is it allows us to sample a whole bunch of different languages, and if there's communities that really are excited about this, then we can look at porting Enhance SSR to their language in order to get the most performance out of things, because we're all about performance at Begin. So
nice. Yeah, I've been playing around with Python using this service called Streamlit. I don't know if you've...
No, I haven't played with that one yet.
It's very interesting because they provide, you know, a client library, and it easily wraps Python scripts with web things, and you can turn a Python script into a web page and deploy it directly to a live environment using Streamlit. It would be very interesting to see how the Enhance SSR with a WASM layer to like cut directly into that Streamlit interface would be at the same time, because I don't know, that would be really interesting. That's very exciting. I'm glad you announced it with us today to know that, you know, you can come at it with whatever language you want. That is very, very cool.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun with it. That's the problem with work. We have like way too much fun. So
that's good.
It allows us to come up with crazy ideas. So yeah,
that is an idea. Whenever somebody's like, we got a WASM thing, I'm like, all right, let's buckle in.
Yeah. You were asking about Begin Deploy.
Yeah. Yeah. On top of Enhance, then we've got Begin Deploy.
Yeah.
Right. And you were going to tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So Begin Deploy is our own way of deploying either Enhance or Architect applications. So this is something that Begin manages. We have a very permissive free tier for anybody that wants to use it. And if you go to, I believe it's begin.com/pricing, you'll see our pricing guarantee. If for some reason your site becomes incredibly popular, we're not going to shut it down on you without, you know, there's been a few reports recently of some like high profile web developers whose sites have been shut down basically because they exceeded their tier. We're never going to do that to you. If you signed up for the free tier or the beginners tier or the professional tier, you know, we'll just work with you. So if you go over your limits for the month, it's like, don't worry about it. We'll take care of that. We'll work with you in order to figure out, you know, a better tier for you, or in ways to, you know, reduce the amount of spending that you're doing. So that's kind of like our price guarantee. But Begin Deploy itself, it allows you to take your applications, create new environments in the cloud, and deploy to it. We also are able, you know, to set up your DNS for you, or if you want to use an external DNS provider, we can, you know, set up the linkages with that as well. Initially, we did this through a web interface for our CI/CD. We've kind of switched to using a CLI. That was a lot of feedback that we had gotten from customers. So that allows you to script things, or that allows you to pick your own CI/CD. yourself. We have integrations with GitHub Actions to make it easier for you to be able to say like, okay, well, this particular repository, anytime there's a Git commit, deploy it to begin staging environment. Anytime there's a tag, deploy it to begins production environment. So that's kind of, you know, our way of doing things. And again, no lock-in. If you decide that you want to deploy your application somewhere else, you can drop down to the architect level and use architect to deploy to AWS. And if you decide that, nope, architect's not for me, again, you can drop right down to using the CloudFormation and deploying using any of AWS's tools. But we really hope to give you the best developer experience possible so that you never have to think about doing that.
Yeah, very cool. You know, for especially for folks that are just starting, giving them a place to use the power of public cloud stuff on AWS without having to go into the console is always a treat.
The console is scary. I mean, that is a lot of people I talk to when they find out that we're built on top of AWS, they're like, oh no, I could never do that. And it's like, yeah, you can. And we've heard that, and this is how you can do it. You run a couple of commands and you're up and running with a web app in no time, and you never had to log into AWS at all. So we can handle all of that, you know, back and forth with AWS in order to get the certificates and the security and all that stuff. But also, if you want to bring your own AWS environment or like your own account and run it on top of Begin's architecture, we can support that as well.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Wow. Well, we've been chatting for a while and had some great stories and conversation back and forth and some awesome news about OWASM, which is, I'm floored. I'm just like, I have to go check this out now.
It's so much fun. We thought it was going to be really difficult to get a lot of this running and just able to support so many languages. Have to give shout out to the XTISM project, which has a way of wrapping WASM and making it available through a bunch of different languages that really helped us get up and running super quickly.
Very cool. I wanted to get your perspective on the future of serverless, because right now, serverless itself has been around a good chunk of time, 10 years or better, right? Like we're past 9, 10, 11 years for when Lambdas came out and people were figuring out this whole functions as a service thing. And now I see ourselves as developers become cloud programmers. Like, yeah, we write JavaScript, we write Python, but the thing that occupies most of our brain space now is how do we put these cloud blocks and cloud services together? Because we're not concerned about allocating memory on physical machines. Now it's like, how do I efficiently process these queues? Do I need a queue? Do I need a database? What kind of database do I need, right? So what is your vision or experience telling you about what the next 5 years of serverless is going
to
be like?
Yeah, and let me just say, I am so glad to be past the server closet phase of things. And folks are like, oh yeah, that's just a saying. It's like, no, I've literally worked in companies where all of your servers were in a closet. And then, you know, when you got a little more machines in there, you had to figure out a right way to run air conditioning to it, or else your servers would go offline. So yes, I am that old. Oh man. Anyway, with serverless technology, like you said, that's been around 9-10 years now, it's really gotten to the point where you can chalk it up to that boring technology that we talked about earlier. There's, you know, if you looked at this, like, you know, 7-8 years ago, you'd be like, it's a little too, you know, new. I don't know if I want to bet my, you know, application or bet my company on this. But now it's a rock solid way of doing things. We have a lot of different architectural patterns that allow us to build on serverless. So it's not a bad choice. And it's especially good for anybody who's just starting, because you don't have to, you don't have to create that Kubernetes cluster. You're probably not going to need that. So you can get started building with serverless right away. You can bootstrap a lot of things. And then over time, if you decide that, hey, I actually do particularly need a server for this one area that has to, you know, perform in a different manner, you can do that. You already have the business logic. You just change it over to a server from a serverless function. So I'm really excited with the way things are going. I think the developer experience for serverless is only going to get better. Personally, I would like to see more people take a pass at what it would be like to do local serverless development. I know that's kind of an oxymoron, but you know, we've had a lot of success with it. And you know, one of the things is that, you know, different projects tend to learn from each other. And so we would like to see somebody else's implementation so we could make ours better.
Very cool. Yeah, local dev is a very interesting place, because I think Arc is the only one that really does it, because Sam uses containers and you have to like use a command line to invoke a particular function, and it's very kind of clunky. CDK, like I still can't get it working. And what is it? The other first party examples, Amplify and all of those, they're very heavy in terms of getting it ready. But when you have an Arc project, and after you install Arc, like that's it. You have a local sandbox that's running and can even do WebSockets. That's what blew my mind when I had an architect project with WebSockets. I could run it locally and it would emulate the API gateway and the Lambda interactions just fine. So highly recommend our listeners go check it out if you've got a WebSocket project and you want to try it out on serverless. I still think Arc's the best way to do it.
Yeah, it's funny they bring up WebSockets. We were just working with some other employees yesterday to convert an architect project over to an enhanced project, and it was using WebSockets, and we're like, nope, just worked fine. It's all good. I was like, that was way easier than we thought it was going to be. So yeah, I think like WebSockets are the technology, which again has also been around for quite some time, but I don't know if people have taken as much advantage of it as they possibly could. You know, you can stream updates down to your web application and have it handle things over the WebSocket instead of, you know, doing polling or fetches or, you know, full page reloads. So yeah, I think when people, if it's easier to set something like that up, they're going to be able to take advantage of it. They're going to find out like a whole bunch more patterns that we can use. And I'm really excited to see where that goes.
All right. Well, now is the time of the show where I have the really important questions, the heavy hitting ones. I noticed that you said you're a comic book fan.
Yes, I am a huge comic book nerd. I am a human Goodreads. I read over 120 to 140 books a year. I know it's a sickness. If you could see the stack of 200 books that is just off to my right hand side here, I plan on reading them someday. It's just the problem is authors keep writing more books.
Never ending content stream. So my very important question for our entire interview today: who is your favorite on-screen Batman?
That is a great question. It's so wild because you've got so many different iterations of Batman.
Yep.
It's like, if you ask me who my favorite Superman was, I'd be like, yeah, it's Christopher Reeves. Yeah, like, it's like, no duh. That one's like, you can believe a man can fly. But Batman's harder because Batman adapts to the times so much differently than a lot of other superheroes do. But I think I'd have to go nostalgic factor is when I was a kid, there is this show on, I think it was CBC, which is kind of Canada's PBS or Canada's BBC. And every Sunday morning, there's this wacky guy who would do a children's TV show. And during the children's TV show, he would show half of an episode of Batman. And like the 1960s Batman with Adam West. So they would show like half an episode and then you'd be like, I got to like come back next week for the other half. And I was like, what a brilliant way of like hooking children for. So my Batman is Adam West. I mean, just that delivery that he had was just amazing. And the campy 1960s Batman, even watching it in the 80s was just, you know, amazing. So
yeah, the it is a Technicolor fever dream for a lot of the Adam West era, and they played it so seriously but it was also extremely campy. And you believed that the world existed as it was. You know, you could just like the scene of him and from the movie, you know, running down the pier with the bomb, like an oversized cartoon bomb in his hand, but it was like a physical prop that they had made. You know, I feel like
shark repellent.
And it was
so well done. And like, folks who haven't seen it should probably go back and check it out. But Cesar Romero, who played the Joker, famously, or maybe some folks don't know, that this very handsome man was very proud of his mustache, but the Joker doesn't have a mustache. So they actually just added more and more white makeup until the mustache was not recognizable. So knowing that as an adult, you go back and you watch it and you can kind of be like, yeah, I can kind of see there's a mustache under that paint. And then Frank Gorshin, who is the actor who portrayed the Riddler, Emmy nominated for that role, which is just mind blowing to think. It's like, this is basically a kids' TV show and one of the actors is getting nominated for an Emmy. It's pretty amazing.
You know, I like your answer of Adam West, because it was a kids' TV show and this is like, it is entertainment for kids. And like it became serious and like sad, like as people wanted more darker, grittier things. And we forgot like, oh, we could still have fun with these stories, you know?
Yeah, that I will tell you that that is the fault of two gentlemen. One is Frank Miller, who wrote The Dark Knight Returns, which is this incredible comic book, which, you know, you go into the future and Batman is like in his late 50s, early 60s. And he comes out of retirement for like, you know, one last go around with things. And it's a 4-issue series. It's been collected. It's never gone out of print. It's great. But it's very like grim and gritty and serious. And then the other gentleman who's at fault is Alan Moore, who is a great comic book writer. And he did a book called The Killing Joke. And again, it's a great, super gritty take on Batman. But DC Comics, the company that produces, you know, the Batman comic books, saw these two huge hits in the 80s and it was like, that's it. Yeah, he's just going to be super gritty and, you know, angry and a loner all the time now. And that kind of put them on that path for a super, super long time. And then as you kind of watch the movies come out, depending upon who the director behind thing was, you could tell when they read Batman comic books. Like, Tim Burton, like, definitely read the super early Batman comic books, like almost like the 1940s, 1950s, like serial like ones. And then when you have Joel Schumacher doing like Batman Forever, like that was more like the 60s campy version. And then Christopher Nolan is like the 80s grim and gritty, you know, 80s and 90s version. So yeah. Anyway, you can cut all this out because I could nerd out about comic books for literal days.
This is perfect. I guarantee you that our listeners are like, they got opinions and they're going to drop them in the comments because that's why we do this. So if you're watching this and you have a comment or an opinion on on-screen Batman portrayals, put it down below. We love the engagement.
Although, I mean, one thing that we did not mention, and it is Kevin Conroy. Kevin Conroy as the Batman on Batman the Animated Series. Like, what a wonderful performance. It's just a voice performance, but the way he's able to give you two distinct personalities between Batman and Bruce Wayne just using his voice is a great job. Unfortunately, the actor has passed away, but I would have been remiss in not mentioning him.
That's my childhood. The animated series. That's definitely my childhood.
I rewatched that recently and it still holds up. And I'm like,
it is very good. Like, so dramatic. It is a very dramatic cartoon.
Yeah. Like, I remember watching it as a younger folk and like, you know, really enjoying it. And then like watching it as an adult and being like, oh yeah, there's some like real layers in here that I was not getting. Yeah. So it's definitely worth the rewatch, folks.
Awesome. Awesome. And with that, Simon, thank you so much for coming on, talking to me today about serverless, all the pioneering work you all are doing, how Begin and all of its open source projects are making the web more accessible, making it, you know, more resilient, coming up with good patterns for local development and infrastructure as code deployments and all of that. Is there anything else you want to plug or give a shout out to for our listeners?
Yeah, I think if folks are interested in anything I talked about here today, the easiest thing to do is go to begin.com. We have a new masthead there that links together Enhance and Architect and Begin and all the different things that we talked about today, including AWS Lite. So it'll be easy to find information just by going to begin.com. And yeah, if you are interested in hearing more about this, you know, hit me up on Mastodon or like any other social media where you can find MacDonST, which is my Unix user ID from university, which is available anywhere because nobody else would want that stupid ID. But yeah, I'm stuck with it now.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thanks so much, everybody, for joining us. My name is Paul Chin Jr. This has been Talking Serverless, where we talk serverless. If you've enjoyed the show, leave a comment and rate the show. If you didn't like it, leave a comment and rate the show. It all helps us. So find Talking Serverless in your favorite podcatcher of choice, and we will see you next time.